20-14061, Carlos Escalona versus U.S. Attorney General, and may take us a moment to set up the remote access for one of our counsel. Can you hear us, Ms. Morazzi?
Yes, I can.
All right. Mr. Militello, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ross Militello for the petitioner. Unless this court has questions about the briefs, I will focus my argument this morning on the issue of persecution and this court's precedent in Martinez v. United States, Attorney General 992, Fed Third 1283. Persecution has always been an extreme concept and viewed in the aggregate. The case of Martinez did not change this. Martinez merely reiterated that credible death threats must still be part of an aggregate that's extreme or an extreme unto itself. It didn't change the state of the law at all, and this case has always fallen within this court's persecution jurisprudence and still does today. The case is cited by the petitioner in his opening brief. Principally, Diallo and Santa Maria are in concert with Martinez in that they are extreme examples of credible death threats being persecution. Here, the aggregate harm that petitioner suffered also in the aggregate is extreme. It occurred from when he was a child all the way up until when he left Cuba. It was something that escalated over time. And within the context of the country conditions in Cuba, shows that it rises to the level of extreme conduct. It's not simple harassment in the street. It was something that was directed at him through his whole life based on his conduct, and the record clearly shows that. The Attorney General's brief here on page 43 shows that they're applying the wrong persecution standard. They're faulting the record, and this faulting petitioner's record for not showing long-standing severe injuries and not showing complete economic deprivation. Those are the only two grounds they show as saying it's not extreme enough. But there's no case law to support that those two things are required to show extreme conduct.
Let me ask you a question about that with regard to employment first. Have we not held that employment discrimination, which stops short of depriving an individual of a means of earning a living, does not constitute persecution?
Correct, Your Honor, but that's not all that happened here.
No, I'm just talking about the employment portion of the...
Yes, on that question. Own, I would agree. That doesn't, just being fired from your job because of political reasons aren't enough to be considered persecution.
Was he deprived of the opportunity to work at all in Cuba, or was he simply deprived of the opportunity to work in a bank?
Hard to say, Your Honor. He did flee Cuba after the credible death threats based on what he had said at the time of his firing. I think it's a reasonable inference that he would have had trouble finding other employment, but that's not really the gravamen of what we're saying is persecution here. It's the physical harm. He did suffer actual physical harm.
I just wanted to be clear, because as I understood the argument, you said there was a confluence of basically two things. One were the beatings, the detention, and the circumstances surrounding that. And the second was that he was denied the opportunity to work. And I was just asking about the latter. With regard to the latter, you would have to show not only that he was deprived of the opportunity to work at a bank, but that he was deprived essentially of the opportunity to earn a living in order for the employment act to amount to discrimination. Am I right about that?
Well, I disagree, Your Honor. I think the error here is in that thinking is that you are separating out the different things that happened to him.
No, I'm not proposing to separate them out. I'm just asking with regard to employment.
Yes, Your Honor.
The law requires that he was deprived of the opportunity to work rather than that he was deprived of the opportunity to work at a bank.
Yes, I think
that's all I'm asking about.
Correct, Your Honor. I think you would look at the country conditions here that were submitted and that, you know, when you fall out of political favor with the Communist Party or when you have made enemies with the Communist Party, employment is something that is highly regulated by the Communist Party. And they could have, and there is evidence that they do, constrict one's ability to make a living and push them out of the official economy. He did not experience that because he left. There is plenty of evidence in the record to infer that is what happened. That's what I talked about. That's what I was talking about when I mentioned we have to look at the context of the country conditions in Cuba when we're looking at whether or not the harm is persecution or just mere harassment.
So are you saying that the employment issue would be enough on its own, or that in combination with some of the other things it pushes it over the edge?
I think if you had a record that said it was just the employment issue and the country conditions show that, as they do here, that Cuba and the Communist Party in Cuba restricts employment and pushes their opponents and people they feel not sympathetic to them out of the official economy, I think you could look at that and find that that you could find persecution there. I think that would be something you would give deference to. If the Attorney General had found that, you wouldn't overturn that based on the precedent. You might not overturn the opposite finding, but that would just be, you know, that would be clear error.
To use our language, if that's all you had, the record wouldn't compel reversal.
If that's all I had.
Correct. Okay, so let's go to what else you have.
Okay. Well, I think in the aggregate, I think the threat of losing your job plus being waterboarded, having your shoulder dislocated, and having that increasing, it's the escalation. The point of the persecution analysis is not to see, did you almost receive death? You know, were you hang in there to the point where you were almost killed by the communist government? It's did the aggregate harm rise to the level of being extreme enough? And when you look at being targeted as a little child when you're in school all the way through adulthood because you refuse to go to parades, you refuse to fly the flag, you refuse to join the party, despite being threatened, despite everything that happened to him, there's no reason to think that that's not extreme enough because he didn't have, and what the government says in their brief, he didn't have a long-standing injury. He didn't have to get medical treatment once he got to the United States for the things that happened to him. His shoulder healed. The fact that you can heal from your shoulder dislocating and the fact that waterboarding didn't kill you doesn't change the fact that...
With respect to the waterboarding, Mr. Escalona testified that his captors poured water on him, and since it was really cold, he almost lost consciousness. That's a little bit different from waterboarding, isn't it?
I don't think so. I think, you know, they poured water on him not to cool him off. I mean, he said it was so cold that he almost lost consciousness. I think.
But he doesn't say he was almost drowned, or I mean, maybe it's a nitpicky point, but
I don't know. It was anymore. I was telephonic for the hearing. It was in a detention center, and the interpreters interpret as they do. My time with him and what I think his statement says is that, you know, he was waterboarded. Or at least something that they weren't giving him something to drink. You know, it was conduct done to punish him for speaking out against the Communist Party and their control over him.
I was more interested in. So he testified that he was told if his captors saw, which was the police, saw him again doing the same kind of actions, they were going to disappear him. And he says that he interpreted that as a death threat. We certainly do have cases where death threats can amount to persecution. So would you talk about that for a moment?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the Santa Maria is the one that really brought that out. And that came in the context of the court deciding what kind of non-physical harm could rise to the level of persecution. And the court decided there that a credible death threat, which was a death threat that can be, that is made by somebody that has the present capacity to carry it out, which usually in the case it's the government actor, and a government actor says, I'm going to disappear you. That case law actually had been interpreted for a long time by many immigration judges to create kind of a per se rule that you reach persecution as soon as the government threatens you with death. And Martinez kind of came in to say, no, it still needs to be extreme. A single incident of a government official saying we're going to disappear you doesn't necessarily rise the aggregate to the level of extreme that's needed for a persecution.
But even under De Santa Maria, and let me say I'm extremely sympathetic to your client. I just think our standard of review, speaking only for myself, is what gives me pause in the other cases. So in De Santa Maria, members of a rebel group captured, beat, and threatened to kill the applicant. Check. But later killed the family's groundskeeper when he refused to reveal the applicant's location, and then captured the applicant and told her that she would meet the local commander and then be killed. And she managed to escape when soldiers attacked the rebel group and freed her. Isn't that threat more imminent than the one that we have here?
No, if imminence is, I mean, I think that's putting the cart before the horse that persecution is death. And I think you can be persecuted without being murdered, your family being murdered. And I think to make De Santa Maria the floor, that you have to be hunted by rebel groups and your family has to be murdered and all that must happen to you before we can find past persecution, you're excluding almost every persecution claim out there because no one's sticking around for that to happen for the most part. In this case, his family is part of the Communist Party. He's the outlier. There's no reason they would go kill his family. They're all sympathetic to him. He's the one that, since he's a little boy, caused problems. And his only solution to these problems is to go be a communist in Cuba, which the whole point of the Cuban Adjustment Act, the whole point of what we've been doing back in INS and DHS for a long time with Cuba was not sending people back to go live as communists in Cuba. Just the sheer fact that you didn't want to be communist was a long time enough. And only under the past administration, the current administration, did we stop paroling based on the end of wet foot, dry foot, but just completely stop paroling these individuals and forcing them into these asylum applications where you're applying standards that weren't meant, the Congress never intended to be applied to the Cuban population. And to the extent that standard continues to increase and get more and more burdensome, you're locking out everybody who is fleeing that hasn't had direct harm to them that is death or death of their family. So, it's just the parade of horribles that comes from continually to allow the Attorney General to raise a legal standard. The standard review here is not clearly erroneous. It's
let me
they apply
you,
the right standard of law, which
counsel,
is clearly not correct on page 43 of their brief.
Counsel, can I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor, please.
Do I have it right that the only issue before this panel now is the determination by the IJ and the BIA that the conduct was not severe enough to constitute persecution? That's the issue. We do not have in front of us a determination by the BIA about the nexus. They say the IJ's determinations were insufficient. So the only issue properly before us now is severe or not severe. Do I have that right with regard to the central issue in the case?
According to the Attorney General, that's the only issue. I think I raised a lot more issues in my brief than that as to why these proceedings were flawed through the very beginning.
There may be of other errors. Do not misapprehend. I'm asking just a really simple question. We don't have the power to make a determination about nexus in this case, do we?
Sure. What the nexus but
let me finish my question, please.
Yes, Your Honor, please. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We don't have the power to make the determination about nexus where the BIA expressly did not and said the findings by the IJ were insufficient. This is a softball question. This is a question designed to help the argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, no, I agree with you. If they've said the immigration judge's findings on nexus are not sufficient, right, you don't have...
Right. So the only thing we can address with regard to this matter is whether there was a real error in the fact-finding process about severity. That's the heart of what's before us. Is that not right?
I disagree. I think it's
okay, the
legal
tell me what else is before us.
It's the legal standard of what is persecution in this circuit. And what the Attorney General has said is not about their fact-finding. I don't disagree with their fact-finding. I don't think I've said they've got it wrong as far as but whether something is severe enough is a question of law, not a question of fact. And the Attorney General makes that clear. They said it wasn't severe enough because there weren't longstanding injuries and not complete economic deprivation.
Technically, it's a mixed question of law and fact. We have
right.
to look at the evidence, and we have to weigh it against some template or standard. All I'm asking is whether we can address the nexus issue, and I think I hear you to say we cannot.
Nexus,
do I have that right?
By nexus, you mean on account of a political opinion?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, correct, Your Honor. You're correct.
All right. Thank you.
You were answering the court's question, so we will give you your full 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Morazzi.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Kristen Morazzi, appearing on behalf of the U.S. Attorney General. Your Honors, if I may first address the issues that opposing counsel referred to with regard to petitioner's asylum and withholding removal claims that were discussed. First, Your Honor, we believe is correct that the issue is whether or not these experiences rose to the level of past persecution. The nexus issue would not be before the court. And to go to that issue of whether or not they rose to the level of persecution, I think it's crucial to consider and remember the standard of review in this case is not just whether the court could find that these experiences did rise to that level, but whether the record compels the reversal of the agency's decision here. And much like the court found in Martinez in discussing the standard of review and discussing the instances that the petitioner experienced in that case, the record did not compel such a result there, and here also does not. I think that as to the looking cumulatively at petitioner's experiences, including the mistreatment and the threats. As Your Honor mentioned, it is distinguishable from the circumstances in De Santa Maria. In that case, the petitioner had many mail and phone threats made. There was an assault in which the petitioner was pulled from the car, pushed on the ground with a foot on their back and threatened with death, treated at the hospital for face and back wounds. Another incident with a death threat that was painted on the petitioner's parents' home.
To opposing counsel's point, though, are those cases really the floor for what it takes for a death threat? Obviously that those cases were sufficient, but is that what it necessarily takes? Does it have to be quite that extreme?
Yes, Your Honor, I don't know that they're necessarily the floor for what has to be demonstrated, but certainly in comparing the circumstances of this case to those, this case falls on the side of the case law that this court has determined situations that don't compel a finding of persecution. It's certainly more analogous to the case law on this issue of taking cumulatively a petitioner's experiences and finding that substantial evidence does support the agency's finding on persecution there.
If I could just follow up and ask you a question. What you have in this case, though, are at least four distinct things that I want to highlight for you, and I want you to tell me why, in the aggregate, they do not yield the conclusion that the conduct was severe enough and that the evidence would compel that conclusion. I agree the standard is clear and the burden is high. First, and these facts are undisputed, if I read this record right, he was arrested in front of his mother and children. He was taken to the police station. By his account, he was locked to a chair, hit in the stomach with a baton 7 times over 5 hours, experienced difficulty breathing and extreme pain for about a week. Let's call that Act One. Act Two, the police detained him at the police station for 30 hours, locked him in a cold room by his account, hit him with batons and fists 13 to 15 times, and threw water at him until he lost consciousness. He claimed, and it's undisputed, that he dislocated his shoulder, and he says he got pneumonia. Third, he says that he was also told by the police that if they came to him a third time, he would, quote, be made to disappear. Wasn't quite the same thing as saying they would kill him, but it wasn't the same thing as saying, have a nice day. The threat to make you disappear certainly would convey a real threat of some moment. And fourth, you have where your colleague began the employment discrimination, that he lost his job in a bank. He concedes that losing a job in the bank would not be enough to compel a reversal, and I think that's clearly right. My question is, why isn't the aggregation of the four of these more than enough and different from any of the cases that were cited, although pieces of those cases were the same? In the aggregate, why doesn't this constitute severe conduct?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly in the aggregate and individually, the situations are unfortunate, unacceptable that the petitioner experienced. But even in the aggregate, under the court's case law and standard of review, we would contend that they, even in the aggregate, do not rise to the point of compelling a persecution finding. I think looking at the circumstances that the court considered, again, in the aggregate in Martinez, which involved detentions, some economic discrimination, several different instances that petitioner experienced as well. Similarly there, the court was sympathetic to that petitioner's situation, but did find that it couldn't disturb the agency's finding unless the evidence was so powerful that a reasonable fact finder would have to conclude that there was past persecution. And we would believe that that's a similar circumstance here. Despite the mistreatment that petitioner experienced, he did not suffer severe injuries. He was never treated at a medical center or hospital for any of the injuries.
Let me ask the question this way. Martinez is the clearest and strongest case you have, right?
I think that there's several cases that we discussed in our brief. Martinez is the most recent,
right,
and shows a set of facts that involve a lot of similarities, yes.
Did Martinez involve all four of the circumstances that we defined here? Two sets of beatings, two sets of detentions, the threat to make him disappear. Let me finish. The threat to make him disappear and getting fired from his job at the bank.
Your Honor, in Martinez, the petitioner was fired from three restaurant jobs in quick succession. The petitioner was threatened that he could be tortured or jailed or disappeared like others had been during an overnight detention that lasted for approximately 20 hours with bleak conditions. That was separate from a different incident in which he was stopped on the street and beaten to the point of unconsciousness. So there were multiple incidents of beatings or detentions in that case. There was economic discrimination. There were threats that were made, similar threats to the threats in this case. I think that the threats that were made in this case are, it's important to note and distinguish them from other cases in which threats combined with mistreatment have been found to establish persecution. Again, the threats in the De Santa Maria case were made in conjunction with not just a prior incident in which petitioner was tortured and had a family employee killed for not giving his whereabouts. That was a separate incident. In the most recent incident of threats in De Santa Maria, the petitioner was caught in a store and watched someone murdered by officers and then was beaten, forced into a car and told, "You will be killed," and just happened to be freed by the military. So the experiences taken in conjunction with the threats of other petitioners where there has been a finding of persecution are different and are more compelling than the facts in this case, given the court's case law on both sides where there has been a finding of persecution versus not. This case is more in line with the cases that have not found such a conclusion. Your Honors, if I may touch briefly on another issue that is laid out in briefs, if Your Honors have any questions on that as well, would be petitioner's arguments for suppression of his identity documents and the statements that he made in his I-213. It's our position, as in our brief, that petitioner's challenge to these documents does not have a basis for relief here because he did not meet his burden of making a prima facie case of an egregious Fourth Amendment violation. The exclusionary rule does not generally apply in removal cases, and as the Supreme Court's found in dicta and other courts have held, that suppression may be warranted for egregious Fourth Amendment violations. But this court has not found need yet to reach that issue because in cases where the court's considered it, it's found that a petitioner failed to make a prima facie showing of an egregious Fourth Amendment violation. And similarly here,
Can I stop you just at that point for a moment?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we had to reach the Fourth Amendment question, let's assume for the purposes of my question, the conduct was otherwise egregious enough. Is it the view of the Department of Justice that there is no Fourth Amendment protection at all, even in the face of egregious conduct?
Your Honor, we don't believe that this case gets even close to coming to that. We would argue that
I accept your position that the conduct here, whatever it was not egregious enough. But I'm asking a different question. Can you imagine a circumstance where the conduct is egregious enough that would yield the conclusion that the Fourth Amendment applies in the immigration context? We've never ruled on that. I'm just curious what your position is.
Certainly, it could be. I wouldn't want to speculate a set of circumstances that aren't, you know, even closely to that point in this case. So without having that set of circumstances in front of me, I wouldn't be able to take a strong position there. It could be. There could be circumstances that could warrant
that. So you can imagine
a
circumstance where the Fourth Amendment applies in the immigration context, right? If it was egregious enough.
We could consider that, but okay. For purposes of this case and this argument, it wouldn't be something that we would concede here for this case today.
But can't the Fourth Amendment apply without having an exclusionary rule? There's been a lot of development on the exclusionary rule since that plurality suggested that there may be some kind of due process egregiousness exception. Aren't those potentially separate questions as to whether the Fourth Amendment applies broadly versus what effect some kind of egregious violation would have in a particular immigration case?
I'm not certain I understand the question, Your Honor. My apologies.
Well, the Fourth Amendment can apply, and it apply, quote unquote, in a situation, right, without leading to necessarily evidence being excluded, right? In criminal
trials. Yes, Your Honor.
So the Fourth Amendment, quote unquote, applying in an egregious case wouldn't necessarily lead to the direct conclusion that the evidence that was taken from that Fourth Amendment violation was excluded, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, in this case, just to touch briefly again on the circumstances of the stop and the facts that we do have in the record from the 213 and from petitioner's declaration, I did want to highlight the circumstances of the initial stop when the officers confronted petitioner. He was walking almost at the border when it was dark outside enough to require lights. The petitioner in his statement mentioned that the officers shone their light on him. I believe it was just after sunrise. And if you look, this is information in the record, the latitude and longitude coordinates, the arrest coordinates, which are in the record on page 469, do show a location that isn't just within 100 miles of the border. It shows a location that's within 2,000 feet of the border on the road directly adjacent to the United States-Mexico border. I'm happy to submit a Google Maps printout that shows that distance with the scale. But so this was in extremely close proximity to the border, which is a factor that can be used in reaching reasonable suspicion to stop and try and determine whether or not someone has illegally entered the country. That and the time of day, I think, certainly went to the officer's reasonable suspicion there. But again, as Your Honors mentioned, this isn't a case that comes close to reaching the egregious circumstances that courts have contemplated might implicate the exclusionary rule. And for those reasons, we don't think that the court should reach the petitioner's arguments as to suppression or reversing the agency's decision in that regard. Your Honors, I believe that my time is nearing an end, and unless there are any other questions from the court, for the reasons laid out in argument today and in respondent's brief, we would ask that the court uphold the agency's decision in this case and deny this petition for review.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to begin back on persecution. I of course agree with Judge Marcus that it is a mixed question of fact and law. However, the factual component of that isn't in dispute here. It's only the legal component here, which is, does the harm rise to the level of persecution? Is it severe enough? Severity is a legal question that this court really has never defined, which is the problem here, because in the agency's decision denying relief here, they just cite to Kazem Zadeh as just point of law saying it's not severe enough. But this case is clearly more severe than Kazem Zadeh, and now we're hearing, well, it's not as severe as Martinez, or it's just as severe as Martinez, and we're doing these apples and oranges comparisons in asylum law every day with what happened to somebody in Colombia versus what happened to somebody in Cuba, what happened to somebody in El Salvador. And it's because this court hasn't, as a matter of law, said what is this standard for severe, what
so
is the standard
how,
for severity?
How would you have us define it?
In terms other than pointing to a prior case that happened in a prior context, I would say some actual qualitative standard on what is severe enough. Is there more than one occurrence? You know, I think in Martinez, there's only one threat. If there's two threats, I think our case is a great example of that, where it is a period of escalating harm throughout this person's life. And I think we can look at nexus. I think nexus, not to the point of nexus as an element of asylum, but nexus as the context in which this harm arose, I think we can look at that to determine, is it persecution? Is it severe enough? That's part of the severity test, is what type of harm was this and what was the reason for the harm besides just the protected grounds. If you're harming somebody because of their political opinion, if you're beating up a priest because of their political opinion of nonviolence, that's different than going after and putting tear gas to disperse a group of protesters. That's vastly different stuff. Both are physical harm, but the context matters. And
I think that's why we traditionally have looked at past cases, because it's really hard to state a rule given all of the different specifics that happen. So say if someone gets pulled into police custody once a month and gently questioned, I think that even though that might be dozens of times of detention, questioned gently for 15 minutes, dozens of times, I think that wouldn't certainly qualify. Whereas obviously if there's a more severe occasion, at one point you have to look into the facts of just how severe it was, all of those sorts of things. So I'm curious how you would have us write a rule rather than make these types of case-by-case comparisons.
I think just as we're doing, Your Honor, I think you write the rule and then the courts have something to base it on. The lower courts, the immigration courts, something to base their analysis on rather than just other cases.
Do you have a proposed rule for us?
Yeah, I think the ones we've laid out here, I think the a long period, a situation where you have escalating harm over a course of a person's life. I think that is a good test for severity. You can solve that in one instance, like in Diallo, where, you know, I was in prison with my brother, they killed my brother in front of me and said, tomorrow is the day for you. Well, that's all you really need. You don't need a lifelong history of escalating harm. You went straight to the top right away. But in other cases where the persecution against the population is more invidious, and is more slow burning, the court needs to have a test that allows the immigration judges to be able to do this factual finding, determine the lifelong history and the aggregate of whatever's happened to this person, and then have a test where you say, is it severe enough? Did it escalate over time? Did it ever go from non-physical to physical violence? Did the physical violence escalate? Did it go from just roughing somebody up to unconsciousness, being put unconscious one way or the other, either being beaten or waterboarded or put in isolation? I mean, there's different ways to do this, and I think a great one is also looking at the context, being able to say that the persecution, whether things are severe, determines on the nature of the context in that country and what's going on in that country. Saying, you know, there aren't rebel groups in some countries. You have leftist dictatorships, you have rightist dictatorships, you have whole different contexts and different ways they go about doing their business. And it's all harmful on account of a protected ground. And we're losing the nuance here because we're fighting over, is it like this Iranian case from 10 years ago? Or is it like this Colombian case from 7 years ago? And we're not actually addressing, is it extreme in that moment for that person in that context?
Let me ask you a fact question, if I could, to help me with this.
Please, John.
Help me with the waterboarding, et cetera. Was he ever asked at any time? I know he didn't say it in his declaration. He said that they poured cold water on him and he lost consciousness. That much, I think, the record says.
Yeah, sure.
Was he ever asked, and did he ever say in words or substance anything like, I was waterboarded, they put me on my back, they put a towel over my face, and they poured water down my face, or anything like that? Or is all we have in the record, they poured cold water on him and he lost consciousness?
I think that's what we have from his testimony that day in court. I think it's what it distills to. I think a statement might have a little more detail. But at the end of that, I think that's also, you know, kind of goes to the change of venue issue, which was, it's my prep of this person was 1 hour a day over a video conference that came in and out because he had to be in Lumpkin. He just had to be in Lumpkin, and there's no choice of moving him. The regulations didn't matter. The regulations about change of venue didn't matter. The regulations about having reasonable suspicion don't matter. It's not a fourth, going shifting gears here, I'm sorry. Fourth Amendment isn't even really what we're saying here. We're saying there was a regulatory violation of regulations promulgated for the benefit of one of the parties. And they just said, oh, no, it's Fourth Amendment egregious violation stuff.
Well,
and I've never said that.
You've raised this now really for the first time in rebuttal, but now that
I cited the cases out of the Ninth Circuit, which...
No, you certainly raised it in your briefing.
Yes.
I'm just talking about it, oral argument.
Well, right, because they raised it just, on the
rebuttal. Just bear with me, then, yes, since you've raised that, that question here. What does the record reflect about all of that?
Which
here, the point you're just making.
About regulatory violations?
Yeah.
About we made a motion for change of venue?
Yeah, does the record, let me be more precise. Does the record reflect any showing of substantial prejudice? That is to say, if it was in South Florida rather than where it was in Lumpkin, we would have called witnesses A, B, C, and D who would have said the following things, and they were unable to appear because of the distance, because of illness or whatever. Do we have anything like that in this record?
No, Your Honor, but I don't think we need to. And I think also to answer your, I think not in the record before the administration, but the reason I can't answer your questions about did they flesh out the waterboarding thing more is we fleshed it out the best we could with what we had. I think if I had been able to see the person for more than an hour a day via video conferencing, we might have been able to get more factual detail. But the issue is there are regulations in place, and the respondents, the petitioners, the applicants, people in removal proceedings are held to a very, very strict standard to obeying by these regulations. And then when the regulations are promulgated for their benefit, they're swept under the rug. They're just maybe guidelines that if we wanted to do something, we would, but they're not enforceable. They're nothing that this court has ever put anything in place that allows somebody in my client's position to be able to say, hey, these rules that you guys put in place to do these removal proceedings, to put people in removal proceedings, you're not even following, and there's no recourse. The exclusionary rule, we don't need to go to the exclusionary rule, just don't let them force people to do asylum on a truncated fast track in detention because they caught them at the border and they couldn't even bother to put the reasonable suspicion in the form I-213 as to why they thought this Hispanic man next to the border in Texas was not from the United States. They couldn't even do that. And even now they're saying, look at the coordinates, he was standing so close to the border in Texas and he was exceedingly Hispanic. I mean, the factual record's not there to say we did it because he was Hispanic, but they essentially just took a brown person standing next to the Texas border and hauled him in front of an immigration judge and put the burden on him the entire time to prove he wasn't properly in front of that immigration judge. The I-213, not an egregious Fourth Amendment violation, isn't saying anything. It just says we think he's an alien. There's no objective evidence as to why.
We've got your argument, Mr. Militello. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next case